Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. And tonight we'll be talking to, well, my two special guests from The Woman. One is the director, Lucky McKee. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. And, of course, the star of the show, Pollyanna McIntosh. Welcome as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, yes, what is The Woman? Well, it's been a film that I've seen on, well, at least five times now. And it has been described as a blunt force trauma at play. And that's from Inside Movies and DVD with Drew McWeeny. Now, that was online. He talked about the film in that way. And it's also been called Not Art, Bullshit, and a Degradation to Women. And that was from the outraged audience member at Sundance earlier this year, which I think a lot of us have heard about. I would describe your film, The Woman, as one of the few rare examples of horror cinema where ideas of what true terror can be like, with a no-frills storytelling style. And to me, it digs a lot deeper into the way, or the brutal way, women can be abused and violated, even in so-called normal family settings. So to me, it spoke volumes about the state of women in some parts of our society, and it makes it pretty clear in a very terrifying way, cinematically. So the first question, for those who don't know about The Woman, Lucky McKee, how would you describe the idea of what The Woman is?
The basic concept of the film is a well-to-do family that lives in a rural area, owns a big piece of land. One day, the father is out hunting on his property, and he spots a wild woman living in the woods, and he decides to capture her, contain her in the basement next to his barn, and attempt to civilize her with the help of his family.
Yes, that's pretty much the bare bones of it, I think. Without giving away too much spoiler, you know, too much of the content for those who haven't seen it, how has the film actually impacted on yourselves with some of the controversy here and there? Obviously, you know, the Sundance Film Festival earlier on. Do you think such a controversy's been good for the film? Does it help focus people focusing on it?
I think with people who love to watch movies and love to see new things come up, if they're told that it's a film that should be banned and burned, as this man suggested, it always encourages people to really want to see it all the more. So
exactly,
the controversy has definitely fueled more interest in the film. And for those who, you know, were fans of Lucky's already, which there are many, they were always keen to see it. But I think this has really opened it up to a wider audience.
Exactly. And for you, Lucky, it's followed you around the world now, so
yeah. I mean, the best result of this, you know, all the controversy is the discussions that people have after watching the film, good and bad. You know, love or hate the film, it makes you really talk about and discuss how people treat each other, which is a pretty important thing to talk about. And the film dissects that. You know, it's not for everybody because it is very extreme. But we, you know, it's the world we live in.
Yeah, afraid so. And it is. You
know, and there's been a lot of people that have come up to me as a result of watching the film that have told me heartbreaking things, you know, about things that they've been to, and you know how much the movie meant to them, because you know we're exposing that sort of that horrible silence that a lot of people have to live in after being in situations like that. You know, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think the thing that upset this guy, it's not as graphic as a lot of horror movies are, and it's certainly not got that sort of torture porn element that I think a lot of modern, especially American horror films have. But I think the abuse that it does deal with cuts pretty deep. I think that's what upset him.
I think what I liked about it as well was the fact that it slowly builds up, and it's like almost two different dimensions. You've got this feral type of woman, wild woman. Who is she? Where has she come from? Is she real? Because I often thought, when I looked at it for the third time, I think it was with Angela Bettis's character, Belle, the mother, it was almost like this exchange between, I guess, the woman and her. And you really wonder, is it the same person? Because the terror that
Belle
lives in,
idea.
The terror that Belle exists in, seems more subtle until she gets, well, spoiler alert, until she gets quite a hiding, I call it, yeah. in the kitchen. Mm. Yeah. That's what we call it in New yeah. Zealand, a bit yeah. of a hiding.
Yeah.
Which is really
It's one of the more brutal moments of the film, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, personally, that's probably one of the worst moments in the film for me.
It turns my stomach when I watch it, and I obviously made the film, you know, because I care so much about Angela as a person.
Yes,
it's such a harsh, harsh moment to take in. But yeah, after showing the film at Sundance a few times, I started to look at the film in a different way, and I think I know what you're talking about. I mean, the woman is a symbol of abuse, you know, and in a way, there are a lot of women and a lot of, you know, just people in general that are in these types of situations that don't have somebody that can set them free.
Don't have a voice as well.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't have she doesn't seem to have a vocabulary that I could make out after watching it.
Yeah, she has her own language.
But
I mean, it's a purely visual performance, you know, physical performance by Pollyanna, which makes it so cinematic.
It does. You know? And I have a question. How, what on earth, why did you do this role? Seriously?
There's not a lot of roles written like this for women, you know,
no.
especially not for, you know, as far as my aesthetic, having come from, you know, originally from a modeling background, I've been passed over many times for those kind of character roles, and she's too sophisticated looking, or she looks too nice, or whatever. And here was somebody offering me a role where that was the complete opposite. You know, I got to be really dirty and grimy, and it was about what I could bring to the performance from inside, and that was really exciting to me. And I just, so it was a really exciting character to play, but also the film overall, I thought, said some interesting things, and just wanted to really kick some ass.
Yeah, and Polly went all the way. I mean, there was a certain point when we were filming in this river, and it was getting, you know, the sun was going down, it was ice cold, and she was just shivering, and just, I was just so worried about her, and just like, Polly, are you okay? She's like, I'm freezing my ass off, I love it. She was just so into it. She just got right down into the dirt.
Yeah.
She just got right down into the dirt. You know,
yeah. Where was it filmed, you know? By the way?
In Western Massachusetts, rural Massachusetts.
Right. Yeah. Was it winter?
When this was? No, it was middle of the summer.
Goodness.
It was in August. It was almost exactly a year ago we started filming.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's amazing that it's only been a year. So it feels like so much stuff has happened since then. You know, it's gone really fast.
Yeah, most of the time it was super, super hot. And then when the light started waning in the water, it was damn cold.
I did want to ask you about the symbolism of right at the beginning, just before the woman, credit comes up on the screen. What was the wolf symbolism? I wondered, the wolf and the baby, what?
Well, that's a dream that I'm having. That whole beginning sequence is brilliant because it shows my life beforehand, you know.
It shows you your subconscious, which is so intimate.
Yeah, and it's so much part of the literature that the character is originally based on. So, and I mean, not my back history, I had a family. And so the child is a symbol of that, and a symbol of the loss of my family just before I enter into this new, in quotations, family. And, you know, wolf's a symbol of freedom as well. So. Yeah.
Well, and also, you know, just
and the hunt.
Just like any dream, I mean, you've just killed a wolf.
Yeah.
And there's a guilt there.
Yes,
that's true. That you had to kill this wolf in order to steal its home.
Yeah, which was a major part of my mythology.
Yeah, but
it
gets interpreted in so many different ways by people, which is wonderful. You know, I mean, I think some people have had interpretations that are much cooler than anything we could have
been
intended.
Being raised by wolves, I was wondering. You know,
a lot of people have said that.
Wolf, you know,
yeah,
families.
And that's what's so fun about you know, doing dream stuff and nightmare stuff, is just getting into the subconscious. Like, it's so freeing and so open to interpretation. And one thing that we really worked hard on in putting the film together was not to explain everything, not to cross everything with a T and dot every I. We wanted people to be asking I get the same questions after the movie all the time, you know, like, did the dad really do this? Did you know what was up with that big surprise at the end? You know, where did that come from? And I always tell people, the film is designed to be watched multiple times, you know, and that's why it's really cool to hear that you've watched it five times. I'm sure you've picked up a lot of the layers, you know, that build towards that ending. But there's a lot of care put into it.
Yeah, especially you working with Angela Bettis again. Now, just a question, and I think most people know you as a director who did this incredible collage horror film, basically. What got Angela into this film? What encouraged her to come on board?
I had to talk her into it.
Really?
You know, because the material was so extreme. But you know, Jack Ketchum and I wrote the role for her. Angela is just, you know, she's so good. You know, she elevates everybody she works around, and she just understands my writing in such a unique way. And on this film, I was fortunate enough to work with all of my leads. Were just so juiced into the material, you know. And Angela, she's just incredible. It's amazing. I mean, it's like seeing someone possessed. You know, if you know her as just Angie, she's just this cute yeah. girl from Texas. You know, real sweet,
tiny,
sweet person.
Quite tiny and she's quite, very petite. Petite, that's yeah. the word. Yeah. But wow, she's...
And she also, she introduced me to Sean Bridges, who plays the lead. So she basically cast that part. Yep. Yeah, yeah. She'd been telling me to work with him for like 10 years, and finally we found the right thing, and he just knocked it out of the park.
He's
incredible. He's like a great Hitchcock villain, you know.
He's yeah. creepy. That's the end of his career. No. Yeah. What if he'll be typecast?
Well, what's great is he's playing so against everything he's done before, because he usually plays like a scraggly bearded southern character with a really thick southern accent. So he's clean cut. I, you know, definitely took the Hitchcock mold for you know, that type of villain. I think it's actually going to expand his career tremendously.
Yeah, no, he is a villain, and it builds so slowly. And there's moments when he's not really doesn't seem that bad as a character.
Yeah.
But he's bad to the bone.
Yeah, and it's the aloof nature. You know, he's so casual about it.
And what he does with his son and that whole relationship, that is just also incredibly disturbing.
Yes.
And realistic.
Yeah.
The bully mentality.
Yes.
The copying the dad, trying to be in favor of the father, and even do worse than him. And the scene where he's taken out of the picture is incredibly violent.
Yes.
Although you don't actually see it.
Yeah.
It's, you're kind of going, yay.
When it happens to the boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've had audiences just cheer, which is odd.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it is odd. But he's the most evil character in the story, I think, the boy, the 12-year-old.
it makes it after watching it last night, it made me wonder again. You know, I was thinking about the role that Sean plays, Chris Cleek's childhood.
Yes.
It really makes me wonder where he came from.
Yeah, and we delve into that a little bit in the book. So, in the book
based on the Ketchum books.
Jack Ketchum.
Jack Ketchum.
Yeah, Jack had written a book called Off Season that was about a clan of cannibals that lived in these caves and attacked these people at this cabin in the woods, you know, kind of a Sonny Bean sort of story. And then he made a sequel to that called Offspring, and they made a film out of that starring Polly. And then they, you know, after they made that film, they asked me, you know, do you have any ideas of how to continue the story? And I said, yeah, if I can take it in a completely different, you know, my own sort of direction, which was basically taking the villain of the previous story and turning her into the victim of the second one. And ultimately, she's the hero of the story, which kind of just turned everything upside down and made it more interesting. So, and Ketchum and I wrote, you know, we decided to write the novel and the script together. So we did that before we shot.
Very Stanley Kubrick
the
of
book's
you.
Out. Yeah, yeah. I was saying I wanted to do like an Arthur C. Clarke, Stanley Kubrick sort of
collaboration,
thing.
Collaboration,
That's what it ended up being.
It's running at, for a limited season, but nonetheless, it is running at the Nova here in Melbourne, in Carlton, Australia. Is that the first cinema to do so, such a sort of run? They are publicizing.
Australia is the first country.
It's our first one, yeah.
It's our first theatrical.
We have distribution in a lot of places, but this is the first one.
Yeah, they're just going right for it. I love it.
So it starts August 18th.
Yeah, and now, we showed it at MIF last night.
Yeah. How was that?
To a sold-out crowd, and they just loved it.
Yeah.
It was
up.
It was great audience reaction.
I mean, people looked pretty shell-shocked when they were coming out of the theater. Yeah.
But no, I think they know what it's like to be
contained.
It's hard and contained because it is a convict nation by origin as far as the white settlers go.
Mm. Right.
And you probably don't have to dig too deep with some people
in Australia
to find some really nasty situations and issues. So I'm sure plenty of people appreciated it on that level. So what happens to the film next? You're taking it to Sydney, is that right? Or
we have another screening on Tuesday here
that's
at
right.
the Nova right the Nova
and
so we're gonna kick that off and then we're gonna go to Sydney.
We're gonna have another premiere at Sydney, and it's gonna be released there, and then we go to Berlin for a festival, and then we go to London for a festival, for Fright Fest.
And we've got Paris and Sweden Spain and all, you know, all sorts of places that we're going to take this. And the film showed at a film festival in Rio a couple weeks ago, and the audience actually voted it best film, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Especially when it's the audience and not just a stuffy jury. You know, that means that the people all filled out their cards. Yeah, it was.
We're taking
really
it to Korea
beautiful.
As well, so
we're excited
about that. That'll be exciting.
This audience is like Korea, you know, and Australia as well, seeing it's a sort of tester market, as it were. It's really exciting to see the support.
Yeah, Korea does for them to discover something, you know. Well.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And they love that. It's brilliant.
And they get the very, very dark humor as well.
And they're so well made, you know, like so cinematic. I mean, that's one of my biggest problems with American film. Mm. And a lot of contemporary film is it feels like everything's filmed by a dude in the bushes, you know. It's just like the shaky camera, and it's trying to create reality by just, you know, like making it, you know, having this faux documentary look, you know. And
which is weird, because if you think about...
That's not the way I see things, yeah. No. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there are times to use handheld and you know, to great effect you can use handheld, but there's so many more tools that have been created over the last 120 years that are, you know, you can do much more interesting things.
Exactly. You know? And this is, would you call it low budget?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Very low budget.
Yeah.
It doesn't look it when you watch it, but... Yeah,
yeah, it's got a very rich look. Yeah, yeah, and sound and soundscape too. I'm really excited about the sound design.
The sound design, and the music, the soundtrack.
Yes,
it's like the furniture in the film. It works so well.
Yeah.
How did you come across? Is it
Sean Spillane? Yeah. Yeah, Sean and I went to college together at the University of Southern California. I was in the film school there, and he was attending school there as well. And our bands played the same parties, and I always liked the songs that he wrote in the band that he was in at the time. Mm. And we were, you know, we knew each other. We weren't really friends or anything like that. And then years later, reconnected with him on Facebook of all things, and said, "Hey man, are you still writing songs? Like, but like your own songs? You're not with that band anymore." And he started sending me demos, and I was like, "This stuff is outstanding."
That's
and
cool.
He already had a few demos that I picked out before the film was made. And then when we went to go make the film, I said, "I don't want to just give you the film after it's all cut together. I want you to come out while we're shooting, and I want you to create the music while we're making the film, so you can feed off that creative energy." So he was just, he must have written like 30 or 40 songs and recorded, and we used about 15 of them in the film, I think. It's really cool to have the music when you go into editing, so you're not using temporary music or anything like that, because music can really affect the way you cut something. You know, it's like I could lay one of his songs down on, you know, on the timeline when editing, and just start editing the movie to the song, and like really fuse them together in a really cool way.
Makes it so affecting.
The way Scorsese uses pre-recorded music is, you know, sort of a similar thing, but it's music from my generation. You know, it's like a style of music that I've always loved,
which appeals to an indie, you know, independent audience.
Sure,
that style,
which is me. You know, you know. So that, and I can't. We're finishing up the soundtrack right now, which will be available on iTunes, and we're also going to make a vinyl. We're going to do a vinyl release, so you'll be able to have an LP, like a blood red vinyl. So cool.
Is it going to have a gatefold with you?
We're going over all the artwork.
Can you make it so?
We're going over all the artwork now, but those are going to be a hot item. I'm really excited. I'm going to be really excited to have that on my shelf. And LPs are still the best format to listen to music on, because the music's uncompressed, you know.
Yeah. So, and you love really the crackle. Excited. Love the crackle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I just want to ask you, how did you find the wonderful is it Shyla Mulhusen?
That's a great story, actually.
Mulhusen,
yeah.
Yeah. Where did she come from?
We were at my father and I were at a horror convention in Dallas, Texas, Texas Frightmare Weekend. And we were at a table signing DVDs and pictures and stuff like that. And I just finished writing the women's script with Ketchum. And my dad says, "Lucky, look." And it's like, he says, "You see that little girl right there?" And he's like, "That's Darlin'." That's that character you just wrote. And I was like, "I think you're right."
Boy.
And we just happened to be mutual. The person that we were with, we happened to be mutual friends with their parents. And we talked to them. Is she interested in acting and all that stuff? And she was. And plus, she's a four-year-old at the time at a horror convention. So she's used to being in that sort of environment. You
kind
know?
Of shows.
Yeah.
Especially where she eats the heads off the cookies.
Her casual nature.
the cookie man.
Yeah, exactly. She was literally picked from a crowd. Mm. You know, and we auditioned a bunch of child actors in New York, and nobody was as good and as natural as
maybe
her.
Maybe they were too polished.
And she really had similar features, similar eyes to Angela and to the girl playing Peggy, the teenage daughter. So it was just one of those magical things that happened.
Well, the casting is brilliant. You've got Zach Rand is
his first film. Yeah,
really,
he'd been doing a lot of stage work, and then this is his first movie, which to me is an incredible honor, because I think that kid is gonna do a lot.
He walked out of the screening at Sundance and turned to his mom and went, "Mom, how did I do that?
Yeah, he's incredible.
He was disturbed by his own performance.
Right, at that age.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. Everybody's going to think he's this evil little shit, you know, but no, he's just a fantastic,
great kid.
Fantastic great. Kid. Really yeah. intelligent. Really, really, you know, his mother's really, really good with him, so.
Cool.
Really cool.
Nice. And, okay, so do you have any favorite horror films that you would say have influenced The Woman? Is there anything in particular? And likewise with you, Pollyanna, is there anything, any performances out there from the past?
Stallone.
That
we talked Stallone about
Stallone in First Blood.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. We talked about Stallone. Yeah. I think that's one of my favorite action films.
He's, you know, that it's.
I was so nervous to suggest it.
I know. So I'm looking at you too, like, should I?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, First Blood, really?
I know. I was like, really? They're going to make me watch a Stallone movie? Oh my God, what are they doing? But it was really great. Yeah. So,
but you
know, my influences are really animals, you know, and sort of ancient mythology of the hunt and how we started off hunting and how we made it okay for ourselves. The human guilt that we feel at killing animals, it's been around since the beginning, and how we created a mythology around that to make it okay for ourselves and to kind of honor them. And that was a lot of the stuff that I was thinking about whilst I was being contained in that environment.
Sitting Bull.
Animals for me, and Sitting Bull.
Okay.
Was a good symbol for me.
Right.
His defiance. Yeah. Strength.
As far as filmic
connection
influence.
To the earth.
Yeah.
But I didn't really watch any actors and go, I want to be like them. I just watched animals and also documentaries on feral children.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That'd be interesting. Yeah, totally. Like there was that Russian kid not so long ago.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that I watched.
And for me, cinematic influence, I mean, I think the best horror film ever made, and it'll probably be the best horror film ever, you know, forever, is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, it's just a flawless, terrifying movie.
With humor. With bizarre twisted humor.
Yeah, and empathy for the bad guys.
And Chainsaw was heavy in my mind because I wanted to do, you know, Toby is the director, the creator of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is a really good friend of mine, and he's pretty much my mentor, you know. I mean, after I made May, we just made friends and we're just really, really close, and he's really helped me through a lot of hard times in the business, you know, with advice and all that kind of stuff. And so there's definitely homage to Texas Chainsaw, but I had to do it in my way, you know. It couldn't be a bunch of rednecks in the middle of the woods. It had to be very clean cut, you know, very well spoken, you know, like the dad's a lawyer and very civilized on the surface, you know. So that was my spin on that, you know, that sort of a horror movie family. And then, you know, Truffaut film The Wild Child was an influence, like I said, First Blood by Stallone.
Straw Dogs
is a big influence. I'm a big Sam Peckinpah in general.
Oh, right.
You know, the editing editing style, especially the last 20 minutes of the film, was very influenced by Sam Peckinpah. We really studied The End of the Wild bunch for that. A lot of Scorsese stuff, and God, it goes on and on. David Lynch, yeah, Peeping
David
Tom.
Lynch, yeah.
Michael Powell, I'm a big Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger fan. And Hitchcock is, you know, I mean, I probably steal from Hitchcock more than anybody, just like everybody else. I mean, he's the Shakespeare of cinema. I mean, he's created so much film language.
And there's a new Hitchcock film. That's been discovered in New Zealand, a Hitchcock film made in 1923 that was found.
One of his silent films?
Found in the woods?
Shut up.
Almost the woods, but yeah.
Wow.
Wow. It was in the news about a week ago. But
I think I'm going to New Zealand.
In New Zealand. Cool, let's do it.
I've been watching all his early silent and his first sound films, his English films lately, and they're just, God.
The guy just wonderful.
Yeah, he's the man.
He is.
And the Hitchcock Truffaut book is, you know, the recordings of, you know, that they made the transcripts for that. Any kid that wants to make movies absolutely has to read Hitchcock Truffaut and watch all the films as they're reading
them.
It. You will learn so much.
Well, there's no excuse. They're available everywhere.
There's absolutely no excuse.
You know.
Yeah. And watch the old British stuff too, you know, watch the silent films and watch how he developed, you know. He's a master.
I still love Dial M for Murder, and, you know.
I got to play Margot in Dial M.
Really?
Stage. That was the first thing I did when I came to LA.
I got to see Dial M for Murder in 3D because he shot that movie in 3D.
Really?
And it was released in 3D at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, and I got to see it in 3D, which is really cool.
Oh, my God.
Look, fantastic. The Woman is going to be playing at the Nova in Carlton from August 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just wonderful. So more people here in Melbourne anyway can see it. I hope it gets taken around the country. I'm not sure yet, but
Sydney definitely. But
definitely, yeah. Sydney.
Yeah,
great.
Come check it out and surprise.
Yeah, and have great. It sparks great conversation too.
So if
you want to go see a film and talk about it all night long, you know, that's what happens to a lot of people. Yeah,
the next day.
Yeah,
like some superhero films I won't mention.
Yeah, exactly.
Plans. Anything you can share, either of you, with us about the future and films or?
I'm in the middle of a movie called The Famous Joe Project right now, which is shooting in LA, and his lead character is a gay character, and I kind of play his best mate.
Oh, cool.
It's about self-discovery and coming to terms with your sexuality and all that good stuff. And then I've got a movie called Nine Full Moons that I'm shooting, and then one called Love Eternal, which is in Ireland, so an Irish film. Mm. And just nice. Planning on working on more good material, yeah. Basically.
So you seem to choose smaller films or more independent type of films, would
yeah,
you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd love to make some fast cash on a big movie, but I've been lucky enough to have been offered yeah. some really great stuff recently, so excellent. The material's good.
Very good. And Lucky, what can you divulge? Anything planned?
The next thing I make is a surrealist noir film, a road movie cut from the same cloth as the good pulpy road movies of the 40s, but obviously in a modern context, and it's based on a Jack Ketchum novella called The Passenger. I'm currently right. giving my own spin on the material right now, writing about halfway through, getting the script in shape. So
great. Cool. You're going to yeah. be busy.
Well, I
hope so. With jet setting around the world and all these festivals.
I know. It's hard. You know? It's hard to find time to write.
Well, it's been really wonderful having you on for a lot longer than I thought would be possible. But I appreciate that for hogging you both.
Thanks
it's
for having
great
us.
Great to have you talk to us tonight and to be on Sci-Fi and Scream. It's yeah. an honor, and I love the film. And in fact, I'll probably go and watch it again.
Oh, I like that. That makes today. Me happy. That's what we designed it. Okay.
Perhaps. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For coming
Cheers.
On.
Okay. I'm Lucky McKee, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Beautiful.
Hi, Pollyanna McIntosh. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. All right.
Thanks.
You're free.
Nice talk. Good talk.
Are you interested in the unknown? Supernatural? Science fiction? Horror or fantasy? On your tally? Or in your books, or at your movie theater. And stay tuned to Sci-Fi and Squeam, the only LGBTIQ gay geek radio show on Joy 94.9. Review of the film The Woman, directed by Lucky McKee. Co-written by Jack Ketchum with Lucky McKee. I need you to understand just who is in charge. I've got kids to raise around here, lady, and disobedience is not something I want them to witness. I would very much like to introduce them to you, but if you're going to be disobedient, I can't do that, can I? And that's from The Woman, directed by Lucky McKee, as I mentioned. Now, in February of 2010, McKee wrote to Chuck Palahniuk's net site describing his film The Woman as an exploration of the very definition of horror. It is designed to incite feelings of fear, shock, nervousness, dismay, anxiety, and disgust. It is designed to make you question what it is to be civilized, what it is to be feral, and all the shades of grey in between. On a surface level, the film will make you jump, it will make you squirm, and, for the more sensitive, it might even induce nausea. It will make you question my intentions in making it, as well as your own desire to watch it. And so, yes, that is pretty much what The Woman is about. That's taken actually from an online site, but it is taken from some words that director put himself. Now, this is a horror film that caused quite a commotion in the US at this year's Sundance Film Festival in January of 2011. And it screens for the first time in Australia in the Melbourne International Film Festival, or MIFF. Its first screening was on July the 30th, and it just had a screening on the 5th of August. Now, that's just two screenings. But fear not, there is great news, because the Nova in Carlton, here in Melbourne, Australia, has picked up the rights to run a season of The Woman, starting from August 18. And on top of that, August 9th, both the director and the main female star, Pollyanna McIntosh, spoke at the Nova during a Q&A and a actual presentation of the film The Woman. So this is my review, my take on The Woman, and I'm going to do the best I can to try and explore some of the ideas, but also to let you, the listener, you know, think a bit about it. And there may be things that, content-wise, that you will not approve of. And if so, you may not want to even listen to this podcasted review. So turn off now. Now, you've probably just heard the interview I had with both Lucky McKee and Pollyanna McIntosh, who were here in Melbourne on Saturday, the 6th of August. It was great to chat to them. Of course, this was the condensed interview. The woman of the film is feral. There's no doubt about it. She must be stinking and filthy. Her hair is plastered with mud and other matter. She seems to have come from the earth itself, and we know very little of who she is and her identity. She's walking through the woods and happens across a cave. Now inside the cave we hear the sound of a wild dog or wolf. And the camera shows the entrance to the cave and the sound of animalistic growls and then the awful sound of death. A wild wolf's death. A few moments later we see the woman lying inside the interior of the cave, dreaming in her sleep. She seems content enough, but the dream is of a wolf and a baby. We're not sure who the baby is and really what the wolf might represent. Well, there's a number of levels it could be. She has a pile of bones next to her of and detritus matter that must have been the animal she's eaten. Meanwhile, in a nice lifestyle house on the outer fringes of the mysterious forest that inhabits the woman, a middle-class white family are having a barbecue. The father, Chris Cleek, yep, that is his name, played by Sean Bridges, and Angela Bettis plays his wife, Belle. Angela, of course, Bettis is very famous for her previous role in the cult classic horror film, also made by Lucky McKee, called May, which came out in 2002. But Angela's a mum now, and she's playing Belle. The oldest child is the girl teenager Peggy. No Peggy Sue, however, here. Oh no, Peggy is shy and undemonstrative and pensive. Why, well, it seems it's hinted that the dad has had a much closer relationship with his daughter than he should have been. And that role is played by the very young but very accomplished young woman, Lauren Ashley Carter. There's also an adolescent boy called Brian, and he's a bit of a sociopath, as it turns out later in the film. It's a sociopath to his dad's psychopathic tendencies. And Brian is played amazingly by young, first-time-on-the-screen actor Zach Rand. So he plays the pubescent boy so well. Now, there is a nasty scene that's particularly horrible and involves Brian, the young boy, getting his hands on a pair of pliers and deciding to take advantage of his bunking school for the day and doing things to the woman that is captured later on. In the cellar, she is held by steel cables and handcuffs. And Brian thinks, well, he might play, and it's not a very nice play at all. Now, this is definitely not for the squeamish, this film. But again, I move too erratically fast-forwarding. Instead, the storyline pretty much goes like this. A horrible white middle-class climbing solicitor, or lawyer, and dodgy it seems to boot, comes across, while he's doing the great white hunter thing, a feral woman, whom he then returns to the forest and plots to capture. After capturing her, he sets up the family cellar as a place where the woman, played with guts and grime so well by Pollyanna McIntosh, with her grunts and animal growls. She's in a crucifixion pose when he finishes with her, held captive by steel cables and handcuffs, and fed oatmeal. In a later scene, with a high-pressure hose gun, she's stripped and blasted with water while tied to a fence railing. She doesn't seem to speak any known language, not English anyway, and she suffers this torture, and there seems to be no hope of escape. The sisterhood of the film do nothing to end the plight of this wild woman. The mother, played by Angela Bettis, is repressed and portrayed as weak. The teenage daughter, Peggy, obviously with child, and is very fearful and insecure. And the youngest female is under the age of 5 and as oblivious, it seems, to most of the mad goings-on of the responsible adults in her life. There are some great little moments from the young actors in this radical film. The teens really work well together, and the fear the female characters project onto the viewer is very uncomfortable. At the same time, it's understandable. Perhaps we could insert these scenes into some domestic scene in the real world, in any suburb, in any fringe religious group, America, Afghanistan, or even here in Australia. Not that they are particularly overtly religious, but they have high moral standards, it seems, and they just want to tame or civilize this wild creature of a woman and wash her and dress her in a costume pretty much designed for easy male access. Now, there's the teenage girl's teacher who tries to intervene, and she's played very well and by Carly Baker. She's the concerned teacher. But I don't want to spoil it too much, but let's just say she's not very successful. Again, I don't want to go on and spoil the movie. It deserves you to go along and see it and make your own mind up and own judgments about it. Just like you did a few years ago. Well, no, sorry, not a few years ago, but like you did last year with last year's yuck film, the low-budget horror The Human Centipede by Tom Six. I'm not saying that the woman is yuck. I'm actually saying the woman is a radical feminist horror. That's what it's been described as, and I have to agree. This film will leave you with something maybe you didn't intend to have on exiting from a cinema today. And that is, it'll leave you thinking, and it will probably cause arguments, at least some heated debate amongst your friends and people you care about who see this film with you, or whenever they see it, if they do. Now, there is something in the Cleek family's barn. I'm not going to go on too much about that. There's something there that shouldn't be, something also wild in nature and hungry. And in the last scenes of the film, it all becomes very blatantly and brutally clear that this isn't the first time they've trapped a human and kept as captive. Now, there's a lot of bloody guts and special effects. They look quite low budget, but it doesn't matter. They're very effective and realistic for what they are. This is, like I said, it's no thrill cinema. It's squirmy in the seat stuff and storytelling. It's the stuff of nightmares. This is hidden horror, but is out for screenings where allowable, where acceptable. And acceptable it may not seem to be. Abuse to women, well, that's a matter of opinion. That this film sensationalizes it has been criticized for doing that, and I don't believe that is the case. My opinion is it still takes a movie like this little horror thriller by a man called Lucky McKee, to make us realise some of us can't sit back and feel lucky inside a movie house when we know that outside our movie house walls, domestic violence and abuse of women and brutality of women is occurring. Yes, so it's a reminder that the female of the human species can still live in terror and fear in our society. But when you strip away, excuse the pun, when you strip away what this movie means and the bare bones of it, I think it's a feminist message. It just happens to be made by a man. So yeah, I think he's been described as the radical feminist horror filmmaker of his time. And all you need to do is go back to his first feature, May, and then work your way forward with the sensitivity he shows towards his actresses and the perspective he takes from each film. He's a very political director. And you know, he's making his message film here. And like I said, it might not be palatable to some, but it certainly is worth a look-see. I give The Woman from Lucky McKee a 9 out of 10. That's me, the screamer. And like I said, it'll be playing at the Nova from August 18, 2011. Tune in for more podcasts coming up. And thanks for listening.
Sci-Fi and Squeam was synthesized and squashed into shape by Sonia.
For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, or check out joy.org.au.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.